Hello, everybody. Welcome to Revive Health's Daily Briefing Live for Wednesday, April 1st, 2020. This is our 30-minute review of the latest, most important news, resources, and advice for health system marketers and communicators who are managing the COVID-19 crisis. I am Chris Bevelo, Health Systems Practice Lead at Revive Health, and your host for the show. And I am joined, as always, by Chase Kluckner, who is Senior Marketing Manager at Revive Health and our show's producer. Hey there, Chase.
Hey, Chris. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. And we are excited to have Vicky Amalfitano with us today. Vicky is a health strategist, consultant, educator, and nationally recognized healthcare marketing leader. She's the former CMO at Brigham Health in Boston and has developed a strategic marketing management curriculum used at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. She's also a friend and a partner of Revive Health. Vicky, good to see you again.
Great to be here, Chris. Thank you.
Yes, thanks for joining. I'm looking forward to diving in with you in a little bit here. As with each show, we plan on covering the latest news on COVID-19 and how it relates to marketing communications in the hospital and health system space, highlight helpful resources, and share what we're seeing and hearing across the industry. We also want to make this an interactive forum. So please, if you have questions for us as we go, you can enter those in the Q&A queue at the bottom of your Zoom window. And we will get to whatever questions we can at the end of the show. You can also use the chat function of Zoom if you want to talk with other attendees. But if you have a question for us, make sure it ends up in that Q&A queue. Also, Chase will be using the chat function to post links as we go through so you can access them immediately. Of course, we provide a recording of this episode in a couple ways. First of all, you can subscribe to the podcast now on iTunes. So that's probably the easiest way, particularly if you're a podcast listener and iTunes fan. But we also provide a recording, a video recording on our COVID-19 communications hub on our website, which is thinkrevivehealth.com. Or if you want to go right to the hub, it's thinkrevivehealth.com/COVID-19, where we have all the recordings of the show, as well as other content that we've developed with the crisis, which we're putting out on an ongoing basis. So just a couple of notes that we always kind of hit before we move through the content today. We are not experts on COVID-19, so not a place to come for medical or scientific advice, but we do have opinions and recommendations on marketing and communications related to this crisis. But keep in mind, everybody's situation is unique. Every community is unique. So in the end, make sure you apply that context to whatever it is we're talking about so it's relevant to your situation. So with all that said, we want to start with some news. First of all, we always start with a count. And we do that just to make sure that we are keeping in mind overall the context of where we're at in this crisis. Obviously, as things continue to get worse, which they are right now, that shapes how we think about everything. And then at some point, hopefully this month at some point, things will start turning around, though even when we hit peak, whenever that is, we'll still be in the thick of the crisis. But as we emerge from it, what we think about and how we act and what we say will be changing. So we use the Johns Hopkins tool. And right now, from an international standpoint, we're at 887,067 cases with 44,264 deaths. From a United States standpoint, we are now up to 190,740 cases and 4,127 deaths, which is, I think I saw somewhere that we should know this, double from where it was just 2 days ago. So continues to accelerate at an unfortunate pace here in the United States. And in terms of news, yesterday, and if you heard it yesterday, pardon me, or if you woke up this morning like I did and started diving into it, it was a particularly bleak day for news. There's no way around that. Long press conference from President Trump and committee members, particularly serious conversation about how hard this is going to be over the next couple of weeks. Some models were shared that predicted the potential of between 100,000 and 250,000 deaths in the United States. Some folks are saying that those are optimistic numbers even. So obviously we have a long way to go. The United Nations said COVID-19 was the greatest threat to the world since World War II. And I know a lot of us at Revive Health have been using World War II as kind of a touchstone for thinking about the impact on the country in terms of sacrifice and other things. There really hasn't been anything close to this since World War II that we can come up with. So that seems to be a marker that is relevant in a lot of ways. And some models are predicting, as I mentioned, peak in the U.S. by the middle of April. Of course, peak just means when we hit the highest number of cases per day, and then we would start decelerating. Though it has taken us from a national level a month at best, maybe more, 6 weeks, 8 weeks. At that point, it'll be at least a couple months to hit that peak. So to come back down, we would see another month or two of cases at a very high level before we're finally through this. And again, even those models may be off. So, you know, Vicky, you were going to add something here. That's all of that's kind of dark. It's the truth. It's what we have to deal with. You know, we don't want to kind of swim in the depressing news, but it's important that we keep it all in context. But I think you had something you wanted to add here.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. One thing that I've been doing in my consulting practice is working with a lot of organizations on communications to physicians. And physicians have really had a pivot throughout the last few weeks on changing approaches, protocols, and instructions. One of the things that I've asked them is about the value of public citizens wearing face masks when they go out. And there's been no real instruction on it. And many of the CDC's hasn't really thought it was going to be very helpful. And now that's starting to change. And the Surgeon General this morning said, you know, we always said that we would keep pace with our advisories with the changing science. And I think we're going to see that citizens are going to be advised to wear face coverings as they go out in public, much as we see in other countries. I don't think it's a bad thing. I don't think it's a scary thing. I think Right. It's a sign that we need to heed the changing data and science.
Yeah, yeah. And it is true. And there will be, obviously, I mean, even yesterday, Dr. Faust and others, you know, there was news headlines about glimmers of hope and starting to see maybe like in Seattle, things starting to slow down. It was kind of overwhelmed by the things I talked about. But to your point, it changes both for the bad, but also for the good. And it's important to keep all of that in mind. So something that you shared too, in terms of resources, and we'll provide a link to this in the show notes and Chase will throw it in the chat, was information that was shared with you, Vicky, from a company called Array. Now, I'm not familiar with Array, so I can't speak to the validity of what it is, but it seems pretty solid. And it was a prediction of state by state in terms of shortages from an ICU bed standpoint. You want to speak to that just real quick?
Sure. So it was actually not ICU beds as much as ICU physician manpower. Okay. And so when you first get to the link, which our Revive colleagues will share with you, it gives you a map. But underneath the map, you can download the model and look at your state where it actually goes through available beds, when the peak will hit, what the bed need will be, what the MD, ICU physicians, so our critical care physicians, what the supply is, what they predict will be the availability based on illness models. And then that's the shortfall. So for your state, there's actually a good deal of information that supports that one simple map. And I would encourage people to take a look at it.
Yeah, it's really helpful. The headline says, to your point, Vicky, it's not about the beds, right? It says most states will face dramatic shortages of critical care physicians, even if additional ICU beds and ventilators are built. So of course, a lot of the focus has been on equipment, a shortfall of the ventilators, PPE, and then beds as an extension of that. But both because of the limited number of critical care physicians to start with, let alone the impact of COVID-19 on caregivers, knocking a lot of them out who come down with it, it's an angle that I haven't heard come through much. So it's kind of a new way to think about the challenges that folks are facing. So I think it's a great resource. So let's kind of dive in on some of the things, Vicki, that we had talked about, having you on and getting your perspective on. And I think one of them that we've been touching on for the past week is the increasing number of stories about hospital and health system at a high level financial strain, but also layoffs and furloughs of what you might call non-essential workers, right? Those folks that aren't able to do anything because the care that they normally would support isn't being offered, like elective surgeries, or they're just deemed non-essential because they can't, for whatever reason, support the COVID-19 effort. So you had some things you wanted to add there, particularly coming, you're based in Boston. That's where your experience has been over the years. So of course you've worked across the country. Some of the things you're seeing there as well.
So one, I really do think we need to, as marketers, come up with a term to replace non-essential workers.
Yeah.
Because that's just like a slap in the face for people who are providing important work at these organizations. So I'll just leave that there.
Yeah.
Medscape has done a study sampling around the country that on average, hospitals today have at most 60 to 90 days cash on hand at a time where their most lucrative revenue streams, namely elective surgery, outpatient procedures, outpatient diagnostics, have basically been halted in order because of mitigation strategies mm-hmm. and to redeploy staff and resources. So given that as a backdrop, there's a really informative article in today's Boston Globe that all of our viewers can go and see because it's got a lot of information on it, in it. So Chris, let me go through a little bit, if I can, mm-hmm. Just some of the factoids in that article. Make sense?
Yes.
Okay, great. So Boston Medical Center is the safety net hospital, a much treasured, well-run organization here in Boston. And they sent out, and I know Kate Walsh, who's the CEO, quite well. Kate was one of my bosses at the Brigham at one point, and I think really highly of her. And she was forced to let people know yesterday that they needed to furlough 10% of their staff, for whom, because of the mitigation strategies and redeployment, really there was no work for. Right. So they're being furloughed, they keep their health benefits, they can use all their sick time, all their vacation time to cover themselves. It might last many of them up to a month. And she's foregoing her salary at least for a month, and executives have been asked to take a cut in pay. Atrius Health up here in Boston is one of, I think, not only New England, but the country's premier multi-specialty physician groups, probably about 700 physicians. And they also have had to do some furloughs and some salary reductions. At another Harvard teaching hospital, very well-respected, Beth Israel Lahey Health, newest merger up here in New England. Kevin Tabb, a fabulous CEO, is taking a big cut in pay for the coming months, has asked all of his executive staff to do the same. We're seeing furloughs around the country now. Bon Secours Mercy announced this week. TriHealth in Cleveland has announced. So we're seeing that it's impacting all of us who are working in the healthcare space.
I'm going to ask you a question because I haven't heard FMLA raised in any of this, and I wonder if in what way that can be used, because obviously that's a law that protects people in terms of their jobs should they need family or medical leave. And in some organizations, it's paid. And I wonder, I have not seen a single thing, anybody mention FMLA, either from a national government standpoint, from a employer standpoint, from a healthcare organization standpoint. Have you heard anything about how that might be leveraged in these situations in terms of layoffs or furloughs, you know, both in healthcare, maybe outside of it as well?
So I can't remember the name of the organization, but I did hear that there was one system that had put some staff on paid leave. And I don't know what the auspices were, FMLA or some other mechanism. The other piece that this gets mixed up with that becomes another management and communication issue is with the labor unions. So that just makes life for providers that have and many of them are dealing with multiple unions. There are issues there. Of course, no frontline clinical staff are being affected. If I can add one more, and this is an interesting one for us here in New England. So Steward Healthcare, which had been based in the Boston area, had a private equity firm that had bought up a distressed Catholic system and turned it private, has bought up other systems, is a national company based in Dallas. They're also doing some furloughs and some cutbacks, and they have, St. Elizabeth is their flagship in Boston, and they let all their physicians know earlier in the week that their salaries were being cut temporarily by 20%, mm-hmm. as well as doing some furloughs. So it's hitting at all levels of these organizations. Boston Medical Center is projecting a loss of $5 million a week.
Yeah, it's crazy. Two things. You brought up unions. We had Elizabeth Musson from Revive Health on yesterday. So for folks who want more in-depth information and recommendations on how to manage that, definitely listen to yesterday's show. Again, you can get that on the website or on the podcast. But the disconnect, I think, if we step away from our industry experience, Vicki, and you're just somebody out in the community, you're just a Joe Public, you're just a resident. The disconnect to me, the dissonance between our hospitals are being overwhelmed, they can't handle all of the patients, and then in the same time, we're having to let people go. It's just so disorienting. Because of course, when you break it down, it makes sense. And when you get into it and you're like, well, these folks they specialize in an area that we can't even offer the service anymore. So it doesn't make sense to have them here, and we can't afford to have them here, and we can't redeploy them. But just at the highest level, it's so odd, you know, as we talk about it and you see headlines about layoffs from hospitals, and yet the story you just heard before that was the cry from hospitals that we need more help because we can't handle it all. So it's just such a weird dynamic.
So fortunately, I think at least here in Boston, and I hope around the country, it's the same. The reporting has had the sort of above the fold portion of the story that these are the so-called quote unquote non-essential staff, i.e. people who aren't directly involved in inpatient care. And I think that's important for folks to understand. But yes, I do agree that if you're not news hounds, you're going to not understand what's going on with these issues.
Yeah, it's really tough. It's just, I mean, obviously it's a unprecedented time and so much confusion and fear, and it, you know, just so many ways you look at this, there's those kind of situations where you go, how can that be? That doesn't make any sense, but it is what it is. So yes. Another thing we wanted to talk about, Vicki, was what you're seeing around command centers in terms of communications in particular. So what are you seeing there?
So with some of the organizations that I advise, the first couple of days, first week of the command center opening is what normally happens when you open a command center. And most of us have opened command centers for things like blizzards, hurricanes. For me, the Boston Marathon bombings a few years ago. And you open it for a few days. Or if it's a major hurricane like Harvey or Katrina, for maybe a couple of weeks, and you know it's going to end. Here, we don't know when it's going to end. So there was the typical sprint to get command center functions in place. And to start what everyone knew is going to be a very complex and long communication journey. So what I saw in the first week or two, and again, it seems like we've been doing this forever, but for most of us, it's been 3, maybe 4 weeks.
Yeah.
For our colleagues in the Pacific Northwest, it's just coming up to 2 months. So yeah. It feels like forever, but it really has not been. So everything got open there, and there normally is an overabundance of communication. So what I've seen is, and it's easy for me in the cheap seats as a consultant to say, you know, I think that you need to standardize some of your content, organize your cadence, all of those good things, Chris, that we advise those that we work for and with. Mm-hmm. I think that's happened now. There just is consistent and regular, but not constant communication. All the tools are up and running, and not just digital tools that are under the direct control of the marketing and communications teams, but the kind of support that they provide to getting apps organized and telehealth up and running and all of that. So I think that the command centers are still stressful. They're 24/7. I totally admire the work that's being done in them. But they're in it now for a marathon and not for a sprint, which is what we're used to in hospital administration.
Yeah, which is, again, just a command center by definition is set up for it's kind of like the SWAT team version of a police force. It's an intense, focused type of situation. And to be able to maintain that level of intensity and focus for months, was just not something anybody's had to deal with in this country. I guess you'd have to go back to war-torn countries and other continents that maybe hospitals have had to deal with that kind of situation on a long-term basis, but we haven't had that here. So again, it just kind of changes, I would imagine, some of the ways they act and some of the things that they're able to do. It's just all new.
So the one thing that's wonderful about the healthcare and those of us who've either worked in or provide different kinds of support to healthcare providers is the amount of collaboration and sharing. So different professional organizations, back channel groups, people putting out, I have to develop a communication on whatever. Does anyone have one that I can model after? And that kind of sharing has just, one, provides a certain level of emotional support, but also just saves people time. Because if XYZ system has had something that's been approved by their leadership, their infectious disease people, their quality people, their legal team, you know it's going to be easier for you if it's something that makes sense for you to adopt. So there's just this tremendous collegiality that's happening across this country in the healthcare marketing and communication space.
Yeah, and what I would say too is that's always been there, Vicki. You know, you joined us at the Joe Public Retreat where we gather together folks like you and top health system marketers. And every year somebody will say out loud, it's kind of amazing that in our industry, you get folks who are kind of competitors. I mean, in many cases, there are direct competitors in that room and they are sharing advice. They are sharing recommendations. They are sharing their pain. And I don't know to what degree that happens in other industries, but I can't imagine it happens to the same level. And undoubtedly it's partly because we're all in this in the end to do good in society and to help people live healthier, to save lives. So our missions are the underlying reason for that. But boy, does that matter now. That collaboration that's natural anyway is just such an important tool, to your point, in a crisis like this.
Really, I just am so impressed with how organizations that I'm working with and that I'm friends with, and it's many, are living their brand day to day, hour to hour, in a way they've never been challenged to before, and they're really doing it beautifully. And I just give all of my marketing, communication, physician, administrative leadership colleagues great kudos.
We sign off this podcast, we'll do it again today, but just saying the same sentiment. And I mean, communications is always important, but it cannot be overstated how important it is now to have accurate, timely communications, not just in service of your organization, because it's critical there. In all the ways we talk about it, supporting your internal teams, making sure your communities understand how to receive care, what's happening. But overall, we need that to get through this crisis. We need accurate, timely information, communications. I mean, I don't know if it's an exaggeration to say communications is half the solution, because I don't want to equate it to the frontline people that are caring for the doctors and the nurses, right? That is so critical. But you know what? The right communications can reduce the number of people, those patients, those people see, and can make sure we're getting resources to the right place. I mean, you really just can't overstate how important it is.
And also that frontline staff, physicians, their other clinical colleagues are getting timely information about the right thing to be doing at the right time. And that's what is coming out of our communications colleagues from command centers all over this country. And that's really important to how we diagnose and treat this terrible disease.
Yep. All right, so where are we at on time? We've got, excuse me, this little thing just won't leave me. Don't worry, it's not COVID-19. Vicky,
you took your temperature today?
No, coming out of the retreat I mentioned in February, there was a number of who actually got the flu, not COVID. And I guess
I did, Chris, just so you know.
You did too.
I did too.
There's at least a dozen people I've talked to who are at this. And one of the side effects apparently of the normal seasonal flu, the respiratory, is that this little shortness of breath cough thing can hang on for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks.
Just got rid of it.
Yeah. So I thought it was getting better and now today it's worse and whatever, but I think it freaks people out when I start coughing and then try not to, right, Chase? I try not to cough into my hand and it's just horrible. Is there one more thing you want to hit? You said you had, and maybe you already covered it, Vicky, but is there an example you want to give of that kind of collaboration? A positive story?
Yeah. So there's a couple of things that that I think are worth talking about. One is a sense from a number of my colleagues in the trenches, chief marketing and communication officers, that this pandemic and the communication needs around it has helped develop a sense of systemness across their enterprise, many of whom have newly acquired either other systems or facilities, and it's really helped bring them together. So that's one thing. And then there's just some neat partnerships, Chris, that are happening. So NYU Langone and Sirius Radio have teamed up down in New York City for, and I've listened to it because I have it in my car and I have apps all on all my devices, a 24/7 COVID-19 channel with constant information and podcasts, and they actually have a helpline. Kind of neat partnership. And this one from Amy at Emory, the Atlanta Hawks, which they sponsor, they're a sponsor of, Emory's a sponsor of that team, has used and purchased take-home meals for Emory staff from local restaurants, locally owned restaurants. So they're doing good in several different ways. And that's just two short stories about how, or three, about how collaborations and partnerships are fostering in this time when we all have so much work to do.
Yeah, that's great. It's a great way to end the show too, because the next couple of days we're going to pivot a little bit and we're going to try to take a look a little bit further. So for example, tomorrow, Brandon Edwards, who's CEO here at Revive Health, is going to join us and discuss, you know, what will things look like in terms of ramping back up for hospitals and health systems once we're coming out of this. And then we're going to spend some time Friday talking about how things might fundamentally change coming out of this in ways that we may not even be thinking about in terms of messaging, perception of hospitals, collaborations. We talked last week about how some of the things that have been taking months and months and years to change, Vicky, like technology and digital innovation are happening in days.
Yeah.
You're right, telehealth and virtual visits and those kind of things. So I think that's a great way to end the show. Thank you so much for joining us, Vicki. It's always,
always
great
a
to
pleasure.
Have you.
Always a pleasure, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And again, if you have something you want us to talk about, please post it in the chat channel right now, or give us feedback. You can always email me at cab@thinkrevivehealth.com. Visit thinkrevivehealth.com/COVID-19 for a recording of today's episode. And of course, subscribe on iTunes. Chase, thanks again for joining.
Absolutely. Looking forward to tomorrow.
Yeah. And to, again, to all of you out there, just like Vicki said, hang in there, keep up the amazing work. You guys are doing incredible things. So important to helping your organization, helping all of us get through this crisis. We'll be back tomorrow and every weekday until this passes. So thanks for joining, and we'll talk to you then.